Hi, welcome. You're listening to the Mike Exchange Podcast, brought to you by St. Michael's College. You'll hear from our larger community on various academic topics and how their experiences have driven them to where they are today.
All right, welcome back to the St. Michael's College Podcast, where we talk about some of the research, some of the discussions, some of the debates that's going on here at St. Michael's College, and also some stories with our alumni and what they're up to. So today I'm joined by another faculty member, Dan Simmons. He's a new faculty member in the political science department. Welcome, Dan.
Happy to be here.
And we're also joined by a St. Michael's student, junior Maggie Taylor. Welcome, Maggie.
Thanks for having me.
And one of the reasons that we asked Maggie to join us today is she's got a lot of experience both in economics and in political science. You know, it's always a good day when you can use a Venn diagram for just about anything. So Maggie, you are the Venn overlap of both myself. I didn't introduce myself. I'm Patrick Walsh. I'm an associate professor of economics here at St. Michael's College. So anyway, Maggie, you're the Venn overlap here. So, you know, what do economists and political scientists have to talk about? Oh, I don't know, maybe, you know, 6 weeks before a major presidential election. Today we're going to talk a bit about how the state of the economy, you know, could impact or is impacting the U.S. elections. And you know, not just what does this do to the horse race, but you know, how are voters thinking about the economy, and how does that translate into how they think about politics? I'm going to start off as the economist here, just giving a real quick summary of where the economy is now. And obviously, so this is the fall of 2020. It's a very unusual situation with COVID having basically shut down most of the U.S. economy in the spring and early summer. So a couple numbers just kind of paint a picture here, give the framework. So the unemployment rate, typically unemployment rate is in the neighborhood of maybe 4 to 5%. When the unemployment rate perks up to maybe 6 or even 7%, you know, that's when we're saying, wow, that's a really serious recession. There's a lot of people out of work. Well, currently, last month, the unemployment rate was at 8.4%. So we're well above even what we typically see in a recession. And actually, back in April, the unemployment rate even visited 10%. So we literally double-digit unemployment. It's recovered somewhat since then. In terms of the number of people employed, just the sheer nose count of people with jobs, either part-time or full-time, there were 152 million people in the labor force in February, and that dropped down to 130 million by April. So we lost more than 22 million jobs because of COVID and the quarantines. We're now about halfway back. We're back up to about 140 million, but we're still 12 million jobs below where we were before the pandemic hit. Finally, in terms of GDP, right? So the nation's economic output and equivalently its income. So if people remember back to the huge financial crisis of 2008, people referred to that as the Great Recession because it was very, very severe compared to most post-war recessions. Well, in that case, back in 2008, GDP fell by 4%. Okay. We're currently looking at about a 10% drop in GDP. So however bad 2008 was, you remember back 12 years, or however bad that was, the current economic crash is more than twice as bad. So that's the background. That's the backstory behind this election. So I guess maybe let's start talking to Professor Simmons here, the political scientist, about we've had data on plenty of elections. How does the state of economy typically affect the presidential election.
Well, I mean, you would think that this election should actually be a pretty open and shut case if we were just voting based off of the economy. So our political science research, one of the biggest scholars in this particular question is Lynn Babrick out at UCLA, and she's written pretty extensively to examine how the economy affects presidential vote choice. And what she's found is that if the economy is doing well, then people are going to be voting for the incumbent president or for the incumbent president's party if they're term limited out. When the economy is going poorly, then if the incumbent president or their party still wants to win, they need to come up with some other issue to tout because they don't have the economy to be able to talk and celebrate. And so when the economy is bad, that's what gives the challenging party the opportunity to be able to sneak in and overturn a presidency. Otherwise, incumbents tend to be fairly strong in general, and if the economy is doing well, it's really difficult to beat them. And we saw that in 2012 with President Obama. You saw it in 2004 with George W. Bush, in 1996 with Bill Clinton, and in 1984 with Ronald Reagan. And so this goes over and over again. These are just our most recent ones. But if the economy is doing well, especially if that president came in, was elected because of a bad economy, and they're able to now show that the economy has gotten better under their watch, then it's very difficult to see how they're going to lose. So you would think that given our current economic situation that Professor Walsh just laid out, this should be a pretty easy case for not just that Joe Biden's going to win the presidency, but that it should be a blowout. But I suspect that's not the case. I suspect that everybody who's listening here knows that's not going to be the case, or is at least fairly uneasy about what the results might be. And this is where we have to kind of dig into some of the other questions about political science when it comes to elections. So it's not always just about the economy. In fact, I'd wager that most of our students here at St. Mike's aren't prioritizing the economy when they think about how they want to vote. They've probably got some other issues in mind that are certainly related to economics. So their student loan debt that they might be accumulating is probably hot on the minds of our college students. And that certainly plays a role into whether the economy is doing well or not, based off of how much debt do the American population have, and how does that affect their willingness to spend on things or engage in more discretionary spending. But it's probably not an issue that we would call an economic issue. And there are other issues that are more specific to the folks here at St. Mike's. It might be things like being able to provide support for colleges, being able to provide support for churches, being able to find ways to take care of basic human rights. So issues surrounding topics around LGBTQ people, women, especially abortion, given the current issues that's going on with the Supreme Court. There are a number of different social issues that come into play in elections. And these would be the issues that if you're President Trump, you want to be playing up those types of social issues right now, because you don't have a great economy to be able to celebrate. Instead, the economy has gotten markedly worse over the last 4 years, and especially over the last 6-7 months. So I think we should expect that President Trump's not going to focus so much on the economy and is going to focus on other issues. And that does seem to be a strategy. He seems to be trying to play up his version of law and order and highlighting what he sees as violence in the streets in major cities over issues that are dealing with police brutality and racial equality. He thinks that celebrating and playing up those types of issues are going to play well with his base and hopefully reorient the election instead of being around the economy or the coronavirus and his performance of that. It'll be on what he can pledge to do on social issues that are important to the Republican base. And so Joe Biden, if he wants to win, it's in his favor to play up how bad the economy really is for people. To really stress that this economy has gotten worse, and why has it gotten worse? In his opinion, because of the presidency and his policies, specifically surrounding how he's handled the coronavirus pandemic.
So I want to give Maggie a chance to you know, talk about kind of, you know, her perspective as a student. But if we kind of pause that for a second, and Maggie, if you can maybe just briefly tell us how you ended up majoring in both econ and political science. Like, how did that come together for you?
Yeah, so so I originally came into St. Mike's as a political science major, just political science. It was kind of after I took a senior seminar course, or no, senior civics course when I was a senior in high school. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of my first introduction into politics, public policy at all, because other than American history. And I was really interested in it. And so I decided to be a political science major based on that. I didn't have anything else to go off of. I pretty much just didn't want to be a business major like all my other friends. So I wanted to be different. So I came into St. Mike's and I was taking some early political science courses. And then I took, spring of my freshman year, I took EC 101 Intro to Macroeconomics, and I was really surprised by how economics and political science are pretty much the same thing, just with different focuses. It's exact same topics that we talk about, but instead of focusing on decisions behind why people do the things they do, like political science, economics focuses on the numbers, kind of different motivations, but it's all the same things. And so it really, I think having both disciplines under my belt helped me with each of it. And I don't want to be misleading, because this year I actually dropped my political science major to a minor. I'm going to be straight up about that. You're probably happy with me, Professor Walsh. You know, I chose economics as my forefront, but I think having both under, you know, both as an experience is really been helpful and fascinating, especially during an election year.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's like vanilla and chocolate. It doesn't have to be either or, right? And kind of, exactly. You know, mix and match, however you want them. Then also, Maggie, I'm just sort of curious, Professor Simmons was sort of talking about how, you know, the state of the economy, you know, the GDP and unemployment and stuff like that I was just talking about, especially for younger voters, really may not be on their radar as much.
I think that's spot on. I think most younger voters, people my age, don't even understand really economic policies. I don't think they know the difference between fiscal and monetary policies. They don't know what all of it means. It's all just kind of foreign to them, because I think that's what a lot of policymakers want, if I'm being honest, is to make the wording confusing so that it doesn't involve younger voters, because it's, you know, they're trying to appeal to emotional bases, I think, instead of the crunching the numbers. But I think based on everything that's happened this year with coronavirus, with Black Lives Matter, with protests, that's really what's on the forefront of most young voters' minds. The environment, I mean, I'm from Seattle, and that's been covered in smoke, which has been worse than it ever has in the past. So those types of issues are really what's on my mind. Even though I'm an economics major, it's hard not to look at what's on the front page of the news and think I should be voting based on that. And so I think that's what a lot of people my age are also thinking.
Gotcha. Yeah. Now, and I don't want to fall into the trap of saying, is this like, oh, everybody between the age of 18 and 25 is exactly the same, right?
Right.
So, what, you know, in terms of discussions that you've been having with, you know, people, you know, in the dorms, right, in classes, you know, if there are kind of points of disagreement, you know, where are those coming from? How, what are kind of the fault lines there?
Well, I think the only people really that I know who are my age who's, I don't want to call them Trump supporters, because that's just putting them into a box, but people who support President Trump are coming from family backgrounds where that's what their parents think, so that's what they go along with. And that's a majority of what I've seen. I've never met someone my age who supports President Trump and whose parents are largely liberal. So I think it's a lot. And I think that, yeah, you can probably agree with that. And so I think a lot of it is kind of understanding like how someone grew up, and that's just, they're going along with what they know. So that those are the types of conversations I have with other students. It's mostly with people whose ideas align with my own, because it's hard to have conversations with people when I feel like it's become such a tense atmosphere where we can't even have open conversations about politics, because it's mostly brushed off with, oh, I don't like talking about politics. My family doesn't talk about politics. And it's such a tabooed thing to talk about that it's almost like, don't bring it up at the dinner table. So I think that that's, and that's unfortunate, because right. Talking about politics doesn't have to be this tense fight that always happens. It's just talking about things that are going on and things that are affecting everyone. But so that's,
yeah. It should be something that you can dig into, but
right.
You know, and I mean, that reminds me of something Dan was saying earlier about, you know, appeals. And I think Maggie, you were saying too, appeals more to emotion than, which, you know, as an economist, you know, this is sort of strange to think about these quote unquote emotions,
right?
Feelings, you know, what people aren't all just motivated by numbers on a spreadsheet. I mean, come on, that's all right. So a question maybe for Dan, you know, in the political discourse, and that is something that I've really picked up on a lot, certainly this cycle, but recently generally, is there's not a lot of policy discussion really. You know, Maggie mentioned, you know, climate and the environment. I mean, that's obviously very consequential and complicated. What we seem to be hearing the most is, you know, it's anger, it's fear. Is that, I mean, has that really always been that way, or has it somehow gotten worse, do you think, over the last several cycles?
You know, I don't know that I would say that it's a new phenomenon. I think if anything, the public is probably better educated and better aware of policy topics and information than they ever have been before, simply because of the day and age that we live in. But talking about policy programs and outlines is a pretty dry and boring conversation. And it's not something that's going to make it into a 30-second spot on TV or on YouTube. And it's not something that a politician is going to bother to take time out of a speech to go into details about their 9-point plan of how to reduce student debt. Instead, what you hear a lot about are policy objectives. So what do you want to achieve? So you'll hear things like you want the United States to be carbon neutral by 2050. You want Black Lives Matter to be true and part of our law and our society and how we interpret things when it comes to criminal justice. You have these ideas and these objectives and these end goals in mind, and that's what gets talked about. That's what makes it into the advertisements. That's what we hear at the speeches. It's what we're going to hear Tuesday and for the following weeks about with the debates that are coming up. And so I don't know that it's really that people are less likely to engage or less willing to engage. What I do think is correct is that they are angrier and more prone to negative emotions when it comes to politics than they have been in quite some time, possibly, at least in the modern era. This is the angriest that we've seen them. I have a colleague and a friend that works at Indiana University who just finished this book titled American Rage, which is, he's done extensive research to look at how emotions and attitudes factor into political behavior broadly. And his conclusions are all focusing on how politicians and candidates are increasingly shaping their messages and what they share to the public in a way that stimulates and provokes anger amongst their base, not towards policy objectives, but towards the other side. So it's this concept of negative partisanship is what we call it in political science, where you aren't, where it's not that you're a really strong supporter of your party and everything that they do. It's that you hate the other guys so much, and that's what's motivating your actions and your votes. So you're not a strong Republican. You just hate all Democrats and everything that they stand for, or vice versa. And so that's the real motivation that I think that politicians today try to play on. So it's not really a policy focus. It's more of an emotional focus.
Right. Now, at the risk of, again, sort of saying this is like, oh, well, you know, all college students are these digital natives who, you know, are, you know, live their lives online. that's an oversimplification. But I'd be curious of Maggie's take about, you know, sort of that negative partisanship, or, you know, those communications coming out that are, instead of saying, here's what I'm going to do, it's a communication saying, this is why the other, you know, my opponent is just the worst thing ever. Do you see social media and, you know, sort of that level of discourse as contributing to that? Is that
so tricky, because social media has such good qualities, and there's so much good that can come from sharing ideas, and like this, it's this platform where there's endless ideas and endless information that you can share everywhere. But at the same time, it's become such a dangerous thing and easy to spread fake news, as we saw in 2016. And so I think people are instant to share things without thinking about what they are sharing. And that's what's kind of created, I think, a big divide in my generation, is people instantly clicking on something and thinking that they should share it with social media because they're like, that's what I believe. And we saw it in 2016 with news about Hillary saying, well, Pizzagate, and news like that, and conspiracy theories that are spreading, and it's just all this craziness. And so it's so hard to determine like what's true and what is not true on social media. And I think that that's something that my generation has to work on, is kind of listening to the facts and figuring out what they should believe, because it's all this trendiness and following a trend on social media, and politics seem to be a trend, like Black Lives Matter is a trend where we post the black square and then we are good and we've taken care of our social responsibilities.
Right. Problem solved, right?
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's really complicated.
I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about, you know, have you either for yourself or for, you know, some of your other classmates, have you seen people sort of evolve in that sense of, you know, what's sort of legitimate news, what's solid data, you know, have people kind of deepen their understanding sort of in their time at St. Mike's?
If they actively want to. It just takes,
right?
It takes a willingness to want to understand. And I do think that for the most part, like coming to college is people who become smarter, to say it, you know, articulate.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So I do think that some of my friends, I've seen them paying more attention, but it's hard because I think I might be the outlier and the person who's so fascinated and so passionate about understanding what the truth is. So I don't know if I can speak on everyone, but I think St. Mike's in general is pretty good at that. I think as a community, like, we're very aware. And I think living in a state like Vermont, that's extremely aware when it comes to like coronavirus, comes to climate change and a bunch of other policies, it's just a good place for knowledge and for real information, but it's hard to speak for everyone, I guess.
Sure, sure. And, you know, I know for my own classes, you know, especially, so I teach things like, you know, economics of healthcare.
Which I did take.
Yeah, right? Yeah, you were in that, in the, whatever that was that we had last spring. I was going to call it a semester. The spring 2020 train wreck, but for a class like that, or now I'm doing public finance, which is very much the overlap of economics and political science. You know, when I'm presenting data, you know, or presenting arguments, you know, I really try to do two things. One being, you know, okay, there's this argument out there. If that argument is true, what would we observe? You know, what trends would we see? What differences would we see? And then do we actually see that? You know, and some theories will be proved right and some will be proved wrong. The other thing, and you know, I could probably be more explicit about this, is, you know, just, you know, where are these data coming from? Like what does a good reputable data source look like? And actually the healthcare class is a good example of that, because, you know, we're pulling from a lot of different sources, but up until now, I think it's sort of, my hope has been that students kind of absorb by osmosis what a reputable data source looks like. But I, you know, I think it may make sense to be more intentional about that. Professor Simmons is, you know, similar kind of things in political science of, you know, kind of teaching that, you know, what's a responsible source, what's a responsible argument, what's, you know, real news versus fake news, I guess.
Yeah, I think a major component of political science is also teaching good civic education. So like I'm currently teaching criminal justice and American constitutional law. My criminal justice students are having a really fun time, I'm sure, putting together some original research projects on topics surrounding criminal justice. So they're having to learn how to play with statistics, how to be able to interpret statistics, not just whether things are good or bad or significant or not, but they're having to really do the difficult part about working with any type of statistical data, which is interpreting it and beyond the numbers. So it's easy to say that we have a regression with a coefficient of 1.79 and it's statistically significant at a p-level of 0.03, which nobody on this podcast understands, right? And nobody who ever listens to this will ever get it. But this real step is translating all of that into what does it really mean? So what does this mean for our criminal justice topic that we're studying? You're studying recidivism among sex offenders. How does this translate into what you're studying? It makes them more likely to commit future crime. If you're looking at sentence lengths for criminal defendants and looking at how that's affected by race, we can run all sorts of statistical tests to give us some kind of estimate and information about that. But then it's up to us as the researchers to interpret that. So how does race really affect the sentence length that a Black defendant or a Latinx defendant or an Asian defendant are going to get versus a white criminal defendant who commits the same crime? My constitutional law students having to wrestle with a lot of arguments about how to interpret the Constitution. And they come in with their own ideas and preferences about what's good in the Constitution and what's bad. And I think it's a fun class where they're having to revisit some of those notions. And they're being confronted with arguments for ways of interpreting the Constitution that they absolutely abhor, but that nevertheless seem to have more constitutional grounding than what they initially thought. And so they're having to really wrestle with this foundational document for how we govern ourselves and translate that to how is that going to affect the types of policies that they support, how they interpret law, whether it's constitutional or not, and put that into practice with their own social justice advocacy. So how can they better craft their own arguments, their own policy goals and ideals in a way that's going to withstand constitutional scrutiny?
Awesome. Well, you know, again, from a perspective of an economist, you know, we started off with, you know, sort of the, you know, a catastrophic economy, this, you know, nail-biting presidential race, and ended up with p-values and statistical significance. So I feel like my work is done here. Like I've, you know, could have gone better from my point of view. To finish up, just last little quick thoughts. If you were talking as both Maggie and Professor Simmons, you know, if you were talking to, you know, a 17-year-old junior senior in high school who it's kind of like hearing about this political science thing for the first time, or even this economics thing for the first time. You know, what advice would you be giving them in terms of what they should be reading, who they should be talking to, you know, what kind of course to chart?
What should they be reading? Probably the newspaper, I would say.
That's a good place to start, right?
Yeah, it sounds kind of, you know, dorky and old-timey, but I think reading the New York Times or reading like a solid place where you're going to get information that you know is credible news, you can make your own decisions on that. And I think talking to adults who seem to know something about it, it's hard in high school, talking to your high school teachers, like history teachers, saying, I'm interested in politics because that's what I did and it paid off. And I'm kind of having a deeper understanding and figuring out ideas that are different from your own. So you can't just adopt the exact same ideas your parents have, because you won't know if it's valid or not, or if it's even true to you and what you value. Right. So I think that was hard coming, you know, coming from like a liberal bubble where I'd grown up and I do believe in the same things that my parents do, but I had to figure that out on my own. And, you know, analyze the data and the p-values.
There you go.
And kind of decide if it was worth investing my time and energy still into the same values. And I've decided that it is. And so I'm pretty confident in that. But I think a lot of people aren't. And most kids these days aren't going to look at the data and analyze and determine things. And so it's hard because we're talking to a niche.
Right. Yeah.
Of students who appreciate politics and economics, which I can tell you is not very many.
So Dan, any kind of thoughts for, a bright student in high school who may be hearing about these?
You know, I would say that Maggie's 100% correct. My advice first would be to read the newspaper. I think that's usually the best way to be able to kind of get a sense of what's out there being talked about, and helps you to be able to decide what it is that you care about and that is important to you and why you feel that way. I'd also add that you should read your local newspapers too. That political issues tend to focus on the national level, but most of the issues that actually matter and affect your day-to-day lives happen on the local level. So finding some kind of local news source, especially since local newspapers have been hurting for a while, and in this pandemic, it's made a bad situation catastrophic. So spare a quarter and go buy your local newspaper, or stop by your public library. They usually have free copies there, and go read that. I think too often people think that political science means you have to be somebody who wants to go into politics or go into law school. Mm-hmm. And that couldn't be farther from the truth, by the fact that I'm in neither of those things.
Right.
But there's plenty of but political science is a great degree for somebody who just wants to be involved in their community.
Awesome.
So if you have something that you're looking to do in your community and you want to know how to be able to achieve your advocacy for social justice or the types of things that you want to see change in your community, political science is the degree to get.
Mm-hmm. My mom was a political science major and she works in marketing. So there you go.
There you go. Right. Right. And that's, I think, one of the real hallmarks of, you know, the way we do liberal arts here at Santa Helena College, you know, in terms of kind of turning people into these Swiss Army brains, right? That, you know, you can take this set of skills in so many different directions. Well, you know, we'd love to keep talking for hours and hours, but it is actually... So it's about 72 degrees and not a cloud in the sky here in Vermont, which is actually, it's like that year round, believe it or not. It's warm, sunny, beautiful all the time here. So anyway.
Sounds like some of that fake news that we've been telling people to avoid.
It's critical thinking. It's critical. Maggie Taylor, junior here at Sam Echoes College, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Professor Dan Simmons of the Political Science Department, thanks so much for your contributions as well.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm Patrick Walsh with the St. Nicholas College podcast, and we will catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Mike Exchange. If you're interested and want to learn more, check out our other episodes.